Teaching is our passion. We at The Wall Street Skinny are proud to announce that we've joined the advisory board for the iConnections Funds for Teachers initiative, focused on supporting the Ron Clark Academy and its pioneering teaching methods. Through Funds for Teachers, iConnections is dedicated to empowering educators nationwide by providing access to RCA's professional development opportunities. Events are being organized in major cities throughout the year to fundraise and support this incredibly important cause. All proceeds from these events will be directly donated to the Ron Clark Academy, specifically to financially aid teachers so they can participate in RCA's groundbreaking training programs. Please click on the link in our show notes to register for an event in the city nearest you. This is The Wall Street Skinny, a podcast devoted to exploring the financial services industry and making the world of Wall Street accessible to everyone. Welcome back to The Wall Street Skinny. I'm Jen.
I'm Kristen.
And guys, today marks our 1 year anniversary of our first podcast episode airing. So for those of you who are new here, we are two lifelong friends with a combined 25 years of experience working and teaching on Wall Street. We are here to demystify the financial services industry and give you the skinny on the world's highest paying jobs. And to celebrate our 1 year anniversary of our podcast, we are joined by arguably our most impressive and inspiring speaker that we've had thus far, our dear friend Ashish Goyal. And I'm going to give you the highlights of Ashish's bio really quickly before we get into it. So Ashish is a London-based investor, and he's a global macro expert, and he is blind. Mm-hmm. So over the past 15 years, he has managed portfolios for, I mean, the world's most
prestigious,
exclusive, prestigious, yeah, marquee hedge funds like Citadel, Blue Crest. He worked for J.P. Morgan's chief investment office. He worked for Balyasny. Yeah. He was the first graduate from Wharton to be a blind person. And he is the first blind trader ever to be on Wall Street. There have since been other visually impaired individuals who've followed in his footsteps, but he is an absolute trailblazer and just a brilliant, kind, funny individual. He's been awarded with India's highest civilian award for a disabled individual. He has been recognized as a young global leader by the World Economic Forum. And he also serves on the board of the Inclusion Initiative at the London School of Economics and the Rising Flame in India. So, I mean, this is just like one of the world's most impressive people.
Well, but it's not just that. Having this conversation, we were so upset because, of course, we were looking forward to this for months. We were so excited about it. And of course, the day that we go to record, our recording platform didn't work. And so we like had to really scramble. We bought like a Zoom membership. But the thing is that when we were recording, it did it in like speaker mode. Normally it records all three of us. And I was actually like so happy because I'm just sitting there bawling the whole time. You'll notice that I don't like say a word because I'm just in tears. I mean, listening to his story was the most moving thing I have ever heard. And it was, this is one of our absolute favorite episodes. It was just unbelievable hearing his story.
One of the things that's been so amazing about getting to know Ashish is that he has both the gravitas, but he also is hilarious and can be incredibly self-deprecating when he talks about what it is like to live life in his shoes. And one of the stories that he or my husband told me, I forget, when they were in business school together, is they used to go out to dinner and the guys would all order whatever and the server would walk away. And if it was a female server, she should be like, oh, wow, she was really beautiful, huh? And they're like, Ashish, like, how can you tell? And he was like, oh, I can tell by the way your voices change significantly when you're talking to a pretty woman versus when you're just talking to some random guy. And the guys are like, yep, you're 100% right. We're guilty as charged. We never even thought about it. Also, I'd known Ashish's story. I've been fortunate enough to know him for over a decade now. I was lucky enough to go to his wedding, actually, in India, which was the coolest thing.
My sister-in-law is Indian, and she didn't have like the Indian wedding, but they incorporated a lot of the sort of traditional parts of it. And like, there's so much kind of cool stuff. The father warns the husband, and the husband like tries to run away, and then the brother grabs him back. And obviously, depending on whether it's Hindu or different religions, there's different aspects to the wedding. But again, it's such a cooler thing. And my mother-in-law mother-in-law was sitting there because we're Catholic, and she was just like, this puts Catholic weddings to shame. Like, this
totally,
is just
totally.
Like,
it is the coolest thing. Yeah. And it's one of my favorite things about having had the opportunity to work in the industry that we did, that you get to know all these people from different cultures. And speaking of different cultures, this is a really awkward segue into, we are quickly going to talk about three body problems because reading Three Body Problem as a white sci-fi reader in America, it's this Chinese sci-fi series that had been translated into English. I read the English translation and now adapted by the Game of Thrones producers to a Netflix series. Mm-hmm. And to me, one of the biggest tragedies, there are many tragedies about how this adaptation has gone down, but one of the biggest tragedies is they made it not Chinese. One of the things that was so great to me about reading that book was that it was written from such a Chinese perspective. And I think so many of the characters' motivations, their decisions, the way they react to things were so thoroughly influenced by Chinese culture that they would have made very different decisions had they been based in London or had they been based in America. And that was kind of the whole point. And that was one thing that was so disappointing to me about how this series actually went down, among many, many, many other things that are disappointing.
It is so funny. Yeah, well, I'd only read the first book in the series, and they actually get into the second book in the TV show. And when you read the book, watching it, I was so disappointed in the parts that I had already read, and I'm watching it, I'm like, oh, this is so... But then when it gets to the parts that I didn't know, I'm like, oh, this is actually great, because like there's a shift that happened. Yeah, I think the same with Game of Thrones. I didn't read the Game of Thrones book, and I loved, like, I mean, honestly, I thought it was great. And anyone who read the books was like, oh, the books are so much better. I mean, the books are always better. I think with any story, you need to read the books. But there was, it was so funny. I was like, I was so annoyed because I think I called you yesterday. And I was like, they did all these things. Like, why did they do this? And then I'm watching the rest of it. And it gets into the Dark Forest where I'm like only whatever, 5% in. And I was like, oh, this is so like cool. Like, this is interesting. Instead of looking at it from a very judgmental lens, I was then just along for the ride. So I think from anyone who has read the book, they're going to be very disappointed and all that stuff. Again, I was so annoyed by certain decisions that they made. I'm like, there was this other part of her story that was so just mind-blowing, and they cut that out entirely. And I called you, I'm like, why did they do that? You know, and I'm trying to be vague here because I don't want to give away any spoilers. But
if you guys are listening, minor spoilers here. But here's the thing. I am so sympathetic to the plight of having to adapt something into a digestible forum and trying to make it easy for everyone. We do this every single day.
Yeah.
You know, in a much smaller scale, right? Or actually, maybe it's a bigger scale, but I don't know, depending on how you look at it. But we are tasked with taking topics in the financial services industry that might be really, really exciting and interesting to like a few nerds and trying to break it down to make it accessible to everyone. And I understand that the producers of these shows have the exact same creative challenge, that they have to take this book that every single person who has read and loved has very, they have very specific visions in their head of what it should look like. And it's a monumental task of making it something that everybody is going to enjoy, because guess what? Netflix won't approve them for a second season if they don't get tons of great feedback. But the problem is, I mean, I'm so passionate about this kind of story. I literally appealed to the English department at Princeton to allow me to write my senior thesis on a Czechoslovakian sci-fi novel because I love the sci-fi genre so much. But what's challenging about these things is, in order to make them digestible, they have to make some creative decisions. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. I actually think they made some really smart creative decisions. These books take place over the course of hundreds and hundreds of years. So they have to keep introducing new characters by default because the lifespan of humans is only so long. And I think they did a great job of starting off with all of the characters having already been friends and following them on that journey together. Yeah. It makes you much more emotionally invested. Mm-hmm.
Well, as you said, each book has a different main character. So it's like, and what they did is they basically took all three main characters from all three books and they put them all into the first book. So you basically are developing a relationship with them over the course of the entire series. It's not just like, hey, now we get to have like a totally new cast, which by the way, lots of series do that. What was the one? Bridgerton, right? Where it's like,
and the Crown
have different,
has done that, where they have to recast the queen every time. Yeah. There's great precedent for it. And I think it's important to build that emotional connection to have things resonate. But the problem was, is in doing that, they made that creative decision really well, but they abandoned so many of the other emotional narrative elements that really help you understand
the characters,
what's at stake, and why the characters made these otherwise incomprehensible decisions, and tried to really shortcut that. And I disagree with a lot of those creative decisions. And I also disagree with the lack of Chinese representation in the film. Because I really think that that was such a cool, important thing that was so deeply steeped in Chinese culture. And I read something on like The Ringer or Reddit, I forget where it was, but it was like, oh, they cut out all the Chinese people except for the villains. So there's like three Chinese people in it and they're all the villains. And it's like, well, except for the heroes.
Jin's not. I guess there's one who's that probably like the main character slash
That's true.
Most likable of any of the main characters.
Yeah, she's the main character from the third block. So she'll be around the longest.
which is great. If things, I don't know what happens to the other two.
Yeah, exactly. If things go as planned. Okay, so now to segue back. We saved it for this weekend to release it. A, for our 1 year anniversary. B, because it's a 3 day weekend. So hopefully you guys will have time to spend a little time listening to this episode if you're listening to it right when it first gets released. And because there's been a little bit of a lag, I do want to say, so in addition to telling Ashish's story, we also get into macro trading, what it means to be a macro portfolio manager, what it means to trade in the markets. And when we had recorded this episode, there were 6 Fed cuts priced in for 2024. And one of the things that you'll hear Ashish talk about is he's like, maybe you think 6 Fed cuts is too much. Maybe you think it should be 3 or 4. Well, guess what? Now only 3 or 4 rate cuts are priced in for 2024. So he was sitting here casually dispensing advice. So we shouldn't have been sitting on this episode. We should have released it. We would have made a fortune if we were trading Fed Funds futures.
Seriously.
But his perspective is just absolutely phenomenal. And I think this is going to be an amazing episode.
Awesome. I can't wait to get into it.
We are joined by Ashish Goyal, who is one of our all-time most impressive guests that we've ever had on this podcast, period, full stop. Ashish, thank you so much for joining us. You have an incredibly impressive resume. Can you please walk us through your background, starting with your personal story, how you got started in finance, and talk through your career to date just briefly so our listeners get a quick idea of who you are?
Absolutely. Thank you, first of all, for having me. And, you know, I've been listening to your podcast and you all are doing some amazing work. So thank you for having me.
Thank you, Ashish.
I would say this is that I became an investor by accident. I mean, I'm half joking. When I was young, I never thought I would ever, you know, do like a master's or 2 masters or anything like that. I wanted to be a tennis player. When I was growing up, you know, I saw Andre Agassi with the long hair and the bandana and the earring, Brooke Shields, and I was like, this is great. I mean, I want to become a tennis player. Life had different ideas. When I was 7, my doctors told my parents that I have an eye condition. That would mean my retina would degenerate and I would lose my eyesight. And as a 7-year-old, that didn't mean anything to me. I kept what I need to do. And eventually, you know, I started learning tennis at the age of 7, 8. And by the time I was 11, 12, you know, the ball started disappearing from across the court and I couldn't play tennis anymore. And gradually, I had to give the dream of playing tennis. I was in love with physics as well. And so I thought, okay, I'll become a physicist. And that it ended up, you know, I had to give up my dream of doing physics as well, because in the 90s, in my teenage years in India, there was no way I could learn physics, or at least I didn't know how I could. And I ended up doing what every other person does in India who doesn't know what they want to do is commerce, or BCom, as we call it, which is accounting and economics. But the good thing was that I was fascinated by how macroeconomics worked. And I became very good with numbers. And accounting, I could do balance sheet in my head and profit and loss statements. But by the time I was 19, I was broken as an individual. I didn't know where life would take me. I'd gone blind. I had gone through a period of abuse, isolation, and, you know, a lot of teasing and things like that. So I had no confidence. I had no drive left. I actually thought my life was over. My career was over. And now when I look back, I mean, I didn't understand depression, what it meant at that time, but I was definitely depressed. Eventually, I got some spiritual guidance from my spiritual mentor. And he gave me 2 pieces of advice that still remain in my head forever. One is, he said, you know, you've gone blind. So that means you don't have your eyesight. That means you've lost 1 out of your 5 senses. So your glass is not 20% empty, it is 80% full.
Oh, I love that.
And the other thing he said was, your brain is amazing. It is continuously thinking about your problem and it's coming up with various ways of thinking about your problem. Now let's retrain it to start thinking about a solution to your problem. That was like, wow. I mean, my brain didn't know how to argue with that. So I woke up the next day, and I woke up with the same kind of trepidation, but I woke up with this amazing glimmer of hope, which was like, you know, maybe life can become better for me. That was 2000 or 1999. And from there, I started taking baby steps. I did a master's in India and I fell so much in love with macroeconomics and finance that the only practical application, and without being an academician or a researcher, was the financial markets. And somehow I convinced ING Bank in India to give me a role in the financial markets. And they asked me what I wanted to do for them. And I said, I wanted to do trading. And that's when I started my career as a trader in 2003.
Wow.
But just the first part of the story, the quick second part of the story is that in 2003, 4, 5, when I was trading in India, I had achieved what I wanted to do. But everything happening in the financial markets then was happening because the Fed was moving interest rates in the US.
Uh-huh.
And also, I had hit a ceiling because ING gave me a job by mistake, but there was no other bank that was interested in talking to me in India. So in one of these conversations, someone told me, why are you wasting your time in India? Go work on Wall Street. And I'm like, what a moron. I mean, he didn't want to give me a job, so he just gave me this free advice, which I didn't want. And eventually that turned out to be an amazing advice because I started researching it. And eventually I realized that might not be a bad idea. So I researched business schools because that was the only way to go from Mumbai to New York. And I realized that Wharton, Chicago, perhaps Columbia would be my best options. I got through to Wharton and Chicago and I came to Wharton. Eventually, the fun thing was I was at Wharton. I was closer to New York and Wall Street. But what I realized when I landed in the US and I started recruiting is there was never a blind person on Wall Street before me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then started this interesting new journey of trying to convince these banks to take a chance on me. Now, what was different about this recruiting process versus India was in India in 2003, a lot of these firms and banks just told me, you're blind, we won't talk to you. Oh. In 2006-07 in the US, because they had to be politically correct, they didn't say that. They wasted a lot of my time and eventually dumped me from the interview without giving me a solid reason. So, but fortunately, I got an internship at JP Morgan in London. And when I came to London to do my internship, after a few weeks, through a certain fortunate number of coincidences, I ended up seeing Bill Winters in his office. Bill Winters was number two to Jamie Dimon at that time. And I said to him, thank you for taking time to see me. I've been at your bank for 9 weeks and, you know, they love me, but, they don't have a job for me. So instead of coming and saying hello, I've just come here to tell you that, can you do something for me? And he said, you know, leave it with me. Let's see what I can do. Then that started a battery of interviews from the top management of JP Morgan. And they took a chance on me. They said, you know, you seem okay. You look good enough. So why don't we give you a role that works for you? And I said, you know, I will never be a good sell-side trader. So why don't you give me prop trading? And they gave me the role of a prop trader and the rest is history.
That is, I mean, seriously, one of the most incredible stories, Ashish. And there's so many takeaways for our listeners from this. Anyone who is feeling discouraged or feeling like they don't have something in their resume, in who they are, in whatever it is that's holding them back. What's your excuse? Okay. Because seriously, if you just listen to what Ashish has accomplished and forging a path in a career and in an industry where there previously was no accommodation for anyone with Ashish's condition, that is just absolutely phenomenal. And I mean, hats off to you. I think it's one of the most inspiring stories that I've ever heard. And I love it. And I already knew part of the story, but I didn't know all of it. I didn't know you literally said like, hey, just give me a job. That's amazing.
I didn't have an option, so I had to ask for things, and I decided to ask for things. Of course, what I also did was, in the meanwhile, I made sure that I was good enough. Two quick incidences I want to tell you. One is there was probably the largest bank in the world at that time in 2006-07. They were on campus, and they had come before the summer internship, and they did their replacement presentations or whatever they got. And so there were 500 people in the room. Now, only 200 of them probably wanted to do banking and maybe 30 wanted to do sales and trading. But after the presentation, when I went to meet the recruiting captain, he said, Ashish, before we waste each other's time, let me tell you, there are 500 people in this room. We will hire the top two people because we are XYZ Bank.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so if you think you're in the top two in this room, then talk to me. Otherwise, let's not waste each other's time. And I was a little surprised. I was like, what? who speaks to anyone like this? I said, okay, you know, when I look around, I don't see anybody. So in my head, I'm in the top two in this room. So let's talk.
I love that.
That is amazing. Oh my God.
I also remember the other quick incident is one of the large Boston-based money managers. They were in town and they had this diversity. Before I came to the US, I didn't know what diversity and inclusion was, but they had this diversity dinner. So someone said, you're blind. You should go to this diversity dinner. I said, okay, I'll go. I registered and I went. What was embarrassing for them and for me was there was a table for gender. There was a table for race. There was a table for LGBT. Mm-hmm. There was no disability table.
Yep.
So I didn't know where to sit. They didn't know where to keep me. But it was a fun evening.
Ashish, are you comfortable talking about how JP Morgan and ultimately your subsequent firms that you worked for have built the technology and worked with you to accommodate not being able to see?
Yes, I'm very comfortable talking about it because I also think when I talk more about it, it helps making things more accessible. So I always talk about it. So when I landed up at JP Morgan, right, they were obviously, it's an amazing firm. I mean, there's nothing more to say about it. They were very open. They said, whatever you need, we will do it. Now, the problem was they asked me, what do I need? And I was like, I've never seen a Bloomberg terminal before, so I don't know what they need.
Right.
And we obviously use something called screen reading software. There was a screen reading software that I still use that is still the best in the world. And I said, you know, let's try this if this works with Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that it could do was read IB chats. I could not read any of those screens, like the four panels or whatever they are.
Yep, yep, yep.
I couldn't read the launch pad, nothing. The only other thing that was possible, which again, Bloomberg got involved with this, was Excel sheets that were live linked to data. Market data were readable. Mm-hmm. So when I started my career at JP Morgan in 2008, the only thing I could access was these Excel sheets with Bloomberg and the IB chats. But that was enough because I had all my market data live and I could trade on the IB chats. And that was the day. And 15, 16 years later, I mean, pretty much 25, 30% of Bloomberg is accessible, if I can say.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah, because I mean, Bloomberg and I have had a really nice relationship. We worked with each other, we fought with each other, and we keep working with each other. And then again, in the last few years, I have to give credit to them. They have made a massive amount of move on accessibility. The first 2-3 years, they didn't know what to do with me. Again, mm-hmm. they were cooperative. They were trying to be cooperative, but there was not a complete buy-in from everybody. But to their credit, it's like a relationship. We stuck to each other. And
I love that. And I really want to come back to that point of, I think Wall Street has made a lot of strides in being thoughtful about, okay, we want to make a deliberate effort on the diversity front. But there has been, at least in my experience, very little effort to bring in people of varying abilities. And so I'm really inspired to hear that Bloomberg and JP Morgan were so willing to work with you. But I'm curious, are there other efforts ongoing to make accommodations for people with differing abilities on the trading floors, in the banks, at the funds that you've heard of?
No, let me say this again. I started at JP Morgan and they were amazing, but I worked at four other organizations after that and they all have been very accommodative. So, I mean, I can't think of any of my employees not being great and accommodating.
Good.
But is there a concerted effort? See, being a student of macroeconomics, I'll tell you this. The accommodations are being made or the effort is being made in terms of economic buy-ins or economic power, right? So gender is the biggest amount of work that has happened in terms of diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. Then comes race or ethnicity or whatever the right term is.
Yep.
Then there's the LGBTQ. The disability group is one of the lowest economically powerful groups in the world. Even though we are 16% of the world's population, our macroeconomic impact or the economic impact or the power we yield is very low. And so it always has been the last thing that, like the story I told you that I went to this diversity dinner and there was no
diversity. Yep.
So that has remained to be the challenge that I've seen. And again, there are efforts, there are different organizations who, a lot of them have even come to me, at least in the financial institution space. Whenever there's a blind individual, I get called on and I know at least four other blind individuals who you know, broken into the markets in some form or the other across the world and in different countries, because, you know, they all put me in touch. So whether banks and financial institutions are making an effort, of course they're making an effort. All of them are. How effective it is, how, I mean, it's very individual, institution dependent, and there's no one, like you, can you say gender has been worked on very diligently? Yes, absolutely, across the board. Yeah. In fact, some of the banks now hire more than 50% women in their graduate recruitment and all that. So, but yeah, disability is a long way away from where it needs to be. And yeah, I mean, there is a lot of work that needs to go into.
So let's get into the nitty-gritty of your actual career on the street here. So let's talk first about being a prop trader at JP Morgan. So many of our listeners don't know about the era of prop traders on the sell side because they all started after Dodd-Frank and after all the regulations. So I'm really curious if you can share some stories about what skills you brought to the table, what skills were required, what the day-to-day of the job was like, all that fun stuff.
I mean, all they need to do is see the Wolf of Wall Street.
Stop. That is absolutely not true, and you know it.
So the easiest way to understand for all the listeners who recently been interested in financial markets or joined the financial markets is to think about a hedge fund within a bank. Mm-hmm. So prop trading desks were basically hedge fund units that ran inside banks. Mm-hmm. Or multiple pods, as we know that there are lots of multi-strategy funds or platforms that run pods within them. One bank could have four prop trading groups in which there could be five teams each or two teams in one and 10 teams in the other. So that's how you would consider a prop trading shop. The difference in every bank was this, that prop trading shops were supposed to be independent risk-taking units, which had Chinese walls from the client side of things, which is the sales and trading side of the business.
Yep.
In some shops like JP Morgan, that was absolutely 100% true. And allegedly, I don't know, because I didn't work at the other places. Some banks, it wasn't true. So sort of information exchange, which again, you know, who knows? Again, I don't know these names and I don't know these people, but that's what I heard from the grapevine. But as we all know, in 2010, President Obama, under him, they brought the Volcker rule and they shut down all risk-taking within banks, at least most of it, the banks that were under the SEC. And since then, the only place to do prop trading kind of roles has been hedge fund space.
And what products were you trading? Were you trading rates, equities, the whole nine yards on the macro front?
I started my career trading currencies and fixed income. So interest rates and currencies, what I started trading. And of course, every macro investor in the world thinks they can trade S&P, but I don't know why, but that's the case. So in my prop group, we had commodities, interest rates, currencies, and equity indices. We traded the whole gamut. And it was amazing because we had specialists in all of them. And for a young associate straight out of business school who had never worked internationally, it was so cool to see how people took risk in different assets. This was also the time of right after the Lehman crisis. Those market moves were absolutely unprecedented. And it was interesting to see how different people adopted and walked through the different market situations.
How would you define macro trading for our listeners who maybe think they understand it, but don't fully have a grasp on what it actually means?
So macro, you know, I often get asked, so, you know, you're an investor. So what equities should I buy? I'm like, guys, my equity is being managed by a friend of mine who runs a fund. I don't know how to invest in equities. So for me, macro investing or macro trading is basically trading countries. So for example, my gamut has always been G7 and emerging market Asia. So I look at, say, let's take G7 countries. I will take a country. I will look at its economic cycle, the macroeconomic policies, whether it's interest rates, growth, inflation, employment, consumption, and all that. And then I will look at central bank policies. I will look at external balances, internal economic balances, and all of that. Mm-hmm. And think about where in the economic cycle is the country right now, where interest rates are being priced, whether they are correctly priced, whether the fiscal situation tells you that the long end of the bond market looks okay or not. And in terms of the, you know, various growth models and inflation models and interest rate models, does the currency look cheap or expensive? Mm-hmm. And you take a very medium to long-term macroeconomic view on both interest rates and currencies. And you also can do that in terms of equity indices, whether you think, depending on the macroeconomic situation, the stock market looks fairly valued at an index level. And that's how you think about macro investing or trading. And now, I mean, I'm not a commodities person, but again, if you were thinking about, say, trading a commodity like oil or something from a macroeconomic point of view, you wouldn't really only go into demand supply of a country, but you would think about global demand supply and what the global growth prospects are for the next few quarters, and then see where the demand supply imbalances, and then take a position or view that oil goes up or down. So it's all at a top macro level. Of course, when you trade individual countries, then you need to do bottoms-up analysis on the individual country.
It sounds like it's very much looking at the fundamentals. Like, it's not so much looking at momentum and all that kind of fun stuff. It's actually understanding the fundamentals of what's driving supply and demand and like all of that kind of fun stuff.
So this is what traditional macro investing or trading is all about. Of course, when I joined the industry, the one person everybody had heard about from the macro world, and even today, if you think about, if you are going to ask people, who have you heard from the macro world? The name that comes often again and again is George Soros. Mm-hmm. Now, George Soros is famous because he broke the Bank of England in 1992, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go and tell someone today in the hedge fund world, you want to be the next George Soros, they'll just laugh at you and they'll let you go and say, oh, please go somewhere else. Because, you know, macro investing has evolved, and now a lot more, along with the fundamental, now we're thinking about momentum, we're thinking about relative value, we're thinking about smaller drawdown limits and things like that. So that's evolved. But again, the basic fundamental remains the same. If you think 6 interest rate cuts in 2024 is too much, then you will try and trade in a way that ultimately you think it's going to be 4 interest rate cuts or 3 interest rate cuts, and you'll take positions accordingly. So the larger thing remains the same. The way they take risk now has changed a lot because of the nature of the industry.
That's such an interesting point too. That just like, you can have a view of what you think is going to happen, but it's like, you also then kind of, this goes to Jen, like who has been, I am not an interest rates person. I don't know any of that kind of stuff. So like, I'm learning about duration. I'm learning about swaptions, but it's like, okay, you have this view about what you think is going to happen. Now, how do I express it? Like, what
how
are the
do you
products
express
I
it?
Use?
What's the best and vehicle, like, and, yeah. and which is the most mispriced, right? So just like you said, Ashish, you might have the view that 6 interest rate cuts is too many, 5 is more appropriate. Okay, how do I express that? Do I express that in Fed Funds futures? Do I express that in 2-year SOFR? Do I express that in 2-year treasuries? Do I express that in some vol form because vol is rich or cheap, et cetera, et cetera? There are so many different ways. So not only do you have to be a macro analyst, but you also have to have a handle on the relative value, richness, or cheapness of those various expressions.
Yes, this is true. But again, I'm going to relate this to, say, the equity side of the business. Again, going back to 2008, I still remember when I was training with JP Morgan in New York before I started working for them. Warren Buffett wrote an article when the S&P was around 800 or whatever the number was. I am buying America and you should too. And he had just bought $10 billion worth of stock at that time across the board. Now, if he was working for today's multi-strategy hedge funds, he would have been stopped out 55 times because he couldn't buy and hold. I'm not saying Warren Buffett runs a hedge fund, but that's the difference between macro investing and macro trading. That, you know, if you think 6 rate cuts are too much and eventually the Fed delivers 3, at some point the market could price in 8 rate cuts and, you know, half the people will be stopped out because of the way the industry is set up, right? So you need to not only be able to, you know, correctly get what the right fundamentals are going to be, but also you need to time them correctly. So way more than you used to before, which again, you know, for the way this the setup is, it works very well for them. And then that's what investors are told, and that's what the investors love. So the nature of the industry has changed quite dramatically.
And, you know, the best advice I ever heard about trading was, the right trade at the wrong time is the wrong trade. And, you know, I think there's so much humility required, but especially in terms of the actual mechanics of leverage that a lot of these funds employ and the realities of mark to market and the ability for investors to redeem their assets. I'd love to get into that a little bit more here in a second. But can we talk about your transition from JP Morgan internally from prop trading to the CIO, and then ultimately how you exited to the hedge fund space?
So yeah, when the Volcker rule came out, obviously the prop desk got shut down, and then all of us were practically told that we would be let go. And I fortunately got absorbed into the chief investment office. Now, the chief investment office, again, without getting into details, was managing the balance sheet of the bank. So it was taking care of all the hedging activities, whether it was the interest rate side of things or the credit side of things or the FX side of things. But also within that, people ran individual portfolios, because until unless you took a risk, you wouldn't know what to do with the market. So it was a hybrid between running portfolios, but the main role was to actually hedge the balance sheet of JP Morgan. And that was great learning, because when I started my career on the prop side, I was a general global macro trader or investor. I mean, whatever you want to call it. I mean, on the buy side, trading is a loose term because we're all investors anyways, whether it was a prop shop.
I love that. I actually want to hammer home that, because occasionally we will use the term trading and portfolio managing interchangeably, and we'll get jumped on by a bunch of internet prophets. And we're like, listen, for all intents and purposes, everyone's a trader. Sorry, but continue.
So, but when I went to the CIO office, what was amazing was I was told that you can be a random global macro investor slash trader, because we're not a prop shop. And that was true, because they did a really relevant job for JP Morgan. And they asked me to specialize in something. So I said, you know, G7, obviously everybody needs to know, because without knowing G7, you can't really trade any emerging market. But because I had the experience of trading in India before, I picked up Asia as the place to specialize. And I started figuring out how the Chinese economy worked and how the Indian economy worked and what to do with Singapore, Korea, and all that. So since 2010 or 11, when I moved to CIO, I have specialized in G7 and emerging market Asia. And then, unfortunately, there was this big blow-up at the JP Morgan Chief Investment Office in 2012. And the Chief Investment Office lost a lot of its ability and size. I realized that that was the last straw, and there was no risk-taking in the bank on the sell side. So the natural exit was to go to a hedge fund. And fortunately, I found a role with Lucrest at that time. And that's when I began my hedge fund career. But again, the role did not change quite dramatically. From the prop side, it got refined a little bit, but I was always running my own book at JP Morgan Prop. I also had a book at JP CIO. And then when I went to Bluecrest, I had my own book.
And so Bluecrest now is functioning more like a family office, right? They don't take external capital anymore, right?
That's what I understand, yeah.
Yeah. But when you were there, it was, I mean, and it still is, one of the biggest hedge funds on the street. And I covered a bunch of traders at Bluecrest who were, I felt like every year there would be like 10 new guys at Bluecrest, and they were all, like, certainly the ones I was covering were mostly relative value or like basis traders and things like that. But so very different from obviously trading from a macro standpoint, relative value being I'm going to take a valuation discrepancy between these two things that are very, very similar, and I'm going to lever up that position massively so that if this thing moves by a fraction of a basis point, I'm going to make an outsized return. That's obviously very different from the macro, long-term thematic trading that you're talking about. Can you talk a little bit about how these multi-strat firms can act as an umbrella for all these different strategies and how capital gets allocated between those different portfolio managers to those different strategies?
Yes, I'll attempt to answer that question. The way it works is, again, it's economics. So first of all, let's start about different strategies. So every multi-strategy fund will have, first of all, asset class strategies. So there'll have been equity strategy, there'll be commodities, credit, and then macro or fixed income slash currencies, whatever. And then they will have directional strategies, RV strategies, systematic strategies. So you could slice and dice according to whatever you want to pick and choose. And some of them would be a combination of one or two or three, right? So it's not necessarily that you have one of this and one of that and all that. So you could have various different teams within a multi-strategy hedge fund doing all kinds of different things. Now, what you spoke about, basis trading or relative value of fixed income, that has been a big bread and butter business for a lot of hedge funds for a long time. And in fact, even if you, anybody who reads the financial, you know, journals today, whether it's WSJ or FT or whatever, you know, there's been again focus on some of these big hedge funds running big basis trades and all that. And and they did that during COVID as well, and all through, right? So, and then Bluecrest is a family office now. Bluecrest has been a very successful business since it became a family office, but it was also a very successful hedge fund before that. And when I joined, Bluecrest was a hedge fund. I was a part of the emerging market team because I had become somewhat of an Asia expert, but all of us did G7 anyway. So we were separate. Our emerging market fund was separate from the fixed income fund that you're talking about, that you used to cover. Mm-hmm. And those guys, there were some amazing people. In fact, the gentleman who was very instrumental in me getting hired to Bluecrest was Charlie Koval, who's just recently retired, I understand, from Bluecrest. And he was one of those people who was a master at RV fixed income trading. I worked for the emerging market team. It was one of the best teams that I've ever worked for. Nick Riley was my boss, amazing boss to have. And I had a great time. I was with them for 4 years and I enjoyed all my time with them. In fact, I left Bluecrest when they announced they would become a family office.
Do you know what led to that decision? Was it just, we've been doing so well, we just want to be investing our own money, we don't want to take outside capital? Or like, do you have any idea?
You know, so I don't know, because, you know, I don't know why they took that decision. But again, looking from outside, you know, if with my business degree hat on, it makes a lot of sense, because you have enough of your own capital and you don't need investors. You don't need to be answerable to investors. And then you can lever up capital because there's so much, you know, money floating around the world. So you just, you know, why would you not use your own capital, lever it up and make more money for yourself and your people? I think it's a great business model, and that's what I think Bluecrest did. Again, I have no insights into what the thinking was, but at least that's what it looks like. And that's why when you see suddenly some of the returns that Bloomberg flashes, that Bluecrest made 150% or whatever, A, the business model is beautiful. That's why they're making so much return. B, you have to also think that 150%, that it's levered. But I don't know whether it's levered.
Right.
8 times or 12 times or 10 times. I have no idea what the number is. But it's great. And you know, Touchwood, they've done really well for themselves.
Well, and I think it's such a good point, because I feel like there is this cynical view out there, which is no one should ever invest in hedge funds. You basically just put your money in the S&P and hedge funds are just trying to be management fee annuities. And it's like, no, like there are some really great hedge funds that are just absolutely like, no, they're not like just trying to collect the management fees. They actually believe in what the investment is and the strategy.
Now, I have a few points to make about this. One, is the S&P the right benchmark for a hedge fund? That's one, one thing to consider. The other thing to consider is, does the S&P always go up? I don't know. I mean, unfortunately, that's what we've been told since 2008, that it only goes up. But if you really go back in time, again, a lot of the analysis that happens nowadays, you have to be very mindful that 2008 to 2024 is not normal market conditions. We have never seen such a lot of central bank intervention and government intervention in the financial markets for a long time, for such a long sustained period of time.
Right.
You know, for all your listeners, the one thing I will tell you is Ray Dalio, whatever you might think of him as an investor, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Ray Dalio, but at least read what he writes, because someone like him has done so much work on the history of economics and markets. It's very important to go back and see what happened in the past. And of course, things are different. You have to adopt those things to the current situation. But just taking 10-year history or 5-year history and 15-year history is not the right way to do things. So one is S&P is not the right benchmark. Secondly, hedge funds are not necessarily competing with the S&P. And thirdly, hedge funds have had a pretty interesting run over the last 15 years. Not every year they've not made money. Some years they've made way more money than everybody else. And then finally, the final thing I'm going to say is, just like, you know, you can't make a blanket statement that equity investing is bad. Of course, if you buy GameStop when it was right at the peak, and it's a bad idea. But but if you were Warren Buffett and you bought all of America when S&P was 700 points, I mean, you would have done really well. So the same way, not all hedge funds are the same. There are some hedge funds, and including a couple of them that I've worked for, that have done significantly beautifully for the past long number of time. So you need to really differentiate between all these funds. Just like you do stock picking, you have to do hedge fund picking. That's what I would say.
I like that.
But that's how you have to do it.
One thing I think you said was really interesting was you talked about not just looking at the past 5, 10, 15 years of history to inform your trading strategy, but look at 50, 100 years, right? Think about the bigger picture. Did you listen to the Jason Cummins episode on Oddlots the other day?
Yes, I did.
So he talked a lot about bringing out the 2006 playbook at the end of a rate hiking cycle, heading into, obviously, I mean, I hope we're in a different situation than we were in 2006 going into 2008.
Oh, no.
I know.
Oh, no.
But I'm curious to get your take on the current economic environment where we have such exuberance in the credit markets and we've got very differing feelings on what the path of central banks are, especially in light of what's going on in China. I'm curious, just as someone who's so knowledgeable about the macro picture here, what are your thoughts?
Of course, I mean, Jason Cummins is very knowledgeable. I heard him, I learned from him when I heard that podcast. I will not comment on what Jason Cummins said, but what I will tell you is, if you've seen the movie The Big Short, right? That guy lived through 06, 07, and 08, and he got it right at the end. Of course, he's been bearish since then. But all I can tell you is, the kind of intervention that happened during COVID, and already we were extremely, intervention was pretty big in the financial markets even before that, is straight out of Ray Dalio's Debt Crisis book. You know, if you read the 2018 book, Debt Crisis, by Ray Dalio, he says what would happen in the next crisis. And during COVID, you literally saw the governments and central banks take everything out of the book and throw it at the market.
Right.
And what is likely to happen? Again, taking a step back, 2009, China did this massive stimulus. It was some huge percent of Chinese GDP. And that started this 5, 7, 10-year bull market in the Chinese economy and the stock market. Fast forward 2020, 21, China did not do that stimulus. And you see the divergence that you spoke about in the last 2-3 years. In fact, even after the COVID reopening, end of 22, people became super bullish, and then it all fell apart very quickly, early 23, because China could not do the same kind of stimulus, or it didn't want to, because it created a lot of excesses. And that divergence has lasted longer than I thought. Of course, the COVID stimulus in the US, the savings have lasted longer than people thought. So the interesting thing is going to be what happens from here going forward. Obviously, a lot of people have jobs. A lot of incomes are looking good. But then the question remains whether we are back to sub 2% inflation on a sustainable basis. I mean, most indicators are pointing towards that. But there are lots of smart people who don't think that's going to happen. And then the Fed has had an interesting, it has been trying to cut off all down business cycles for the past 15 years. Whether inflation allows it to do that again this time, I have no idea. So we are in a very path-dependent time in the markets. Are there excesses? There are tons of excesses at different points in different parts of the world. Growth is not that strong across the world, and geopolitical stress is actually, I didn't bring in geopolitics till now, but I should have earlier. Geopolitics has become a very important part of macro investing. And I know, all the bottoms of equity guys don't care about micro or geopolitics at some point, but it is becoming more and more relevant since 2011, I should say, from when the European crisis came about.
Great and very thoughtful answer, Ashish. Thank you so much. Circling back to your experience at Bluecrest and Citadel and Balyasny, you've worked at the most prestigious macro and multi-strat hedge funds out there. We have so many listeners who are young candidates coming up through the industry who have hero worship for these big pod shops. We'd love any color you can share. Obviously, you were coming in as a senior portfolio manager, but we'd love any color you can share about your take on the interview recruiting process, the overall philosophy of whom they're hiring into these funds, and also how these funds differ as far as culture and internal paths from, say, what a lot of people think of as hedge funds, which are like the old equity long short guys.
I mean, again, see, I'm very grateful to all the funds that I worked for. And I have to say that I enjoyed working for all these three, four different units. They were all very different from each other. But the one thing that was common was they had some really smart and nice people. So that has been the common factor amongst all these funds. Now, without getting into specifics of any fund, I can tell you is what the young people need to do is work on the fundamentals. A lot of people think that if they can just figure out what the RSI is and what the price
movement is. What is RSI?
These technical, like a lot of people do technical trading, right? So relative strength, like short momentum, or what the Elliott wave, whether we are in ABC or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Again, I'm bringing in these jargons because a lot of people just look at charts and form technical analysis, and then they trade and they think this is how trading works. Again, that's a tool you should use, but you also need to have your basics in place. You need to work really hard and smart. So there's no working around working hard. I mean, you can't just let me just, ask ChatGPT to summarize this report. Because, the most interesting things are not the numbers. So does every hedge fund know what the GDP growth in the US was last quarter? Yeah. I mean, does every person know? Yeah. What NFP is? Yes. I mean, when the non-farm payroll numbers come out, I've seen some of the smartest people not even touch the market. Of course, 90% of the market wants to buy or sell S&P or rates after that or before that.
Right.
And that's great. That can work. But the thing to do is to really read a lot, understand things, and pick up on the nuances that make a difference. Because to differentiate yourself and to do well, you need to have your own analysis, your own thinking, and not just listen to a bank strategist come out of a meeting and sell, 100 million euros. That's not how it's going to work. So also, in terms of skill sets, you need to understand macroeconomics. You need to understand market liquidity. You need to understand different markets and their functioning. We also need to have nowadays statistical and analytical skills, more and more computing skills, because a lot of it is getting systematic, or at least you're using a lot of these statistical analysis to understand the behavior of markets and depth in markets and things like that.
Do you think that these days it's a non-negotiable that people who are interested in this probably need to have coding background and all that kind of fun stuff, or not necessarily?
Not necessarily coding, but you can say that I don't know how to do a simple standard deviation analysis or regression or something like that. I mean, again, there are tools to do that, but you need to know what the tool means, right? Because if you get an answer, you know what to do with that answer. So that's important. And then the idea is also that a lot of people from the sell side is the training ground, because there's no proper desk anymore. A lot of people on the sell side, they need to understand that going to the buy side is a completely different ballgame, because you don't see customer flows. You don't see what clients are thinking. There are 50 chats that all these sell side people have with 50 clients. So you know what 50 clients are doing. But when you're sitting on the other side, you have no idea what the other 49 are doing. You need to know that you will be thrown in the deep sea pretty much alone, and probably your boss and your team. That's it. There's no support system. You don't have the comfort of making the money from the client flows and things like that. So you don't have any buffers there. You also need to understand the setup very well, because like I said, drawdowns have reduced, leverage has gone up. And the best way to start your career is to work for a senior PM.
Can you just explain when you say drawdowns, what that means?
So stop losses have reduced. So for example, so let's say 15 years ago, if you ran a $100 million portfolio, you would have room, say, down to 10 million or 12 million negative before you were asked to unwind your book.
Or you get the tap on the shoulder.
Exactly. Or probably lose your job. Now that has probably gone down to $4 or $5 million. And that too, or maybe six. And that too, you'll have 2-3 serious conversations before you go to six.
Got it.
So that has changed. Mm-hmm. And the best thing to do for anyone coming from the sell side wanting to be on the buy side is to try and work in a team and work for a senior portfolio manager and learn from them and work with them and help them in the investing process and then start taking risks themselves. That's what I would think.
And really dumb question, what are those roles actually called within these groups? So you've got senior portfolio analyst. Manager. Oh, sorry, analyst?
Analyst, yeah. Okay, so this is different from the banking, you know, analyst associate, maybe AMD. This is not the same analyst. You're just an analyst for a portfolio manager.
And that's you're basically like a research analyst. So it's like you're supporting them.
No, research analysts are different. So you're an analyst or you're called a sub PM or you're called, every
a junior PM or something like that. Yeah.
Associate PM. Now, I mean, an associate PM at one fund could be risk taking and the other fund could just be someone who comes up with ideas, executes and things like that. So it really depends. Everything has their own thing. But analyst, junior PM, associate PM, sub PM, whatever.
Got it. Okay. So the analyst is actually just a title, the same way like a associate is a title.
Like capital A.
So a PM is only called a PM when they take risk. Mm. Otherwise, you could be a junior PM or you'll be an analyst. Now, single managers, there are a few single managers left that, again, like Rokos is a single manager or however. So nobody else takes risk there, or at least that's what I understand from the outset, or nobody else was able to take risk there. It would all feed into one person. But eventually, a lot of other places, there are different pods. Everybody takes risk. And within those pods, there's a PM and then there's junior PMs who also take risk. Some of them, some don't. So the structures are very different everywhere. Now,
That's so interesting.
Also, what is different is, on the equity side, a lot of analysts are just research analysts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's important to know. And then in macro funds, most of my research people, some really smart people, they would be called strategy teams or research teams. Mm-hmm. So that would be they would actually be called research analysts or research or strategy, whatever. So again, these lingos are quite jumbled up and individual to individual fund, but it's obvious what your role is depending on where you work within the fund.
Are those strategy resources socialized among all of the portfolio managers? Like, can you ask someone on the strategy team to do dedicated research just for you and say, like, keep this secret from the other portfolio managers because I've got this trade idea and I don't want anyone to know about it?
No, I don't. I mean, in the multi-strats, I can't speak about everywhere because one multi-strat is different from the other. But in the ones that, I understand better, no, you can't ask a strategy person to keep things secret. Now, like every other organization, there are 4 pods out of 60 that make money and more money or way more money than the others. If they ask or one of them asks the strategy person to do some work, that will be remain quiet. And it will get socialized, but not to the extent that every other pod knows. But again, some funds, pods don't even talk to each other. Some funds.
Well, I was gonna ask actually, that. How do you guys avoid groupthink? How much is there a collaborative effort and their camaraderie, and how much is there competition for capital allocation?
Well, I was gonna say, and slash, like if you are ultimately, they're probably, I'm assuming, like you don't want to have too much correlation between different pods. Right. So is it like if one pod takes a risk with or has some bet, I assume that might restrict what another pod can do because big picture, right? Like you don't want to be super skewed on because ultimately my understanding is these pods are a little bit diversifying each other out. So I would love for you to talk about that. That's so interesting.
Again, there's no right answer. So of course, every fund has risk committees that have fund limits. So mm-hmm. every fund will have a limit of how much interest rate risk they can take, how much equity exposure they can take, and how much currency risk they can take. And within that, there would be buckets of front-end risk in the rates market, the 5-year part of the curve, the 10-year, 30-year. And in currencies, it could be euro, cable, China, whatever. Mm-hmm. So everything has buckets. So at a fund level, the fund has to remain within a bucket. At least that's how I understand it. Mm-hmm. And then every portfolio manager has their own risk limits. Now, mm-hmm. can there be groupthink? It's easy to figure that out when you see if all funds lose money in a certain quarter or all funds make money in a certain quarter, because I mean, I don't need to have worked at a hedge fund to figure that out. So that's, there is some correlation, but there are some funds where, you know, you don't even know who works in the other pod, or at least you don't talk to them. And so, yeah, it's again down to individual hedge funds. And, you know, most of them manage correlation pretty okay. They have some smart people looking at risk and all of that. There are firm-wide risk limits. There are individual risk limits. And I think some of the funds also run management books, et cetera, to make sure that they hedge out any extreme risk or correlations.
And so when you say running management books, that's probably something that people who haven't traded before don't understand how that works. Can you explain that a little bit?
Suppose there's a fund called XYZ and they're running 10 pods. And suddenly the managers who are overseeing these 10 pods see that, okay, 8 out of these 10 pods are long 10-year treasuries.
Mm-hmm.
Then at the management level and risk committee level, there is a committee which includes the senior managers and risk people and strategists. They would say, okay, we are extremely exposed to, as a fund, 10-year treasury risk. And we are long a lot. So then we will buy some options, or
we'll hedge it out some way.
By some other correlation asset that gives us the correlation benefit of hedging them.
Got it. Very good. And another question for you. I've heard rumors or suggestions that there is pressure to constantly stay invested. Like, what if you get to September and you're like, I have crushed it. I was given whatever, $500 million to manage, and I am up 45% on the year. I want to be done. I don't like the market here. I think it's garbage. I want out. I want to close out my positions from the year and go take a nap.
Yeah.
Are you allowed to do that? Or do you always have to keep a certain amount of value at risk, of VAR, invested?
So that's a great question. Again, unfortunately, a lot of these answers are, it's all down to the individual fund.
Uh-huh.
One of the biggest alpha for macro investors is to know when to scale up risk and then to hunker down and have very limited risk when they don't have an opinion or they don't have a view.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in some hedge funds, they think that because the investors have given you money and they need to, you need to be fair to investors and keep investing. And the others are like, yeah, this makes sense. This is how macro works. So you can take your risk down. And there's no right answer. I mean, when I say no right answer, I mean, different funds do it differently. And in some funds, so there is definitely pressure. There is pressure to keep invested.
Mm-hmm.
In some funds, they're pretty relaxed about, as long as on an average, you run a certain amount of risk through the year, they're okay with it.
Oh, so they think about it on like a average basis throughout
some
the year.
Some funds think about it on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
The same for returns. Like a few years ago when I was interviewing with one fund, they're like, oh, we want you to make 0.8% every month. I'm like, sorry, I'm not buying like these high yield bonds that I'll make 0.8% every year. But, you know, I'm a macro guy. Sometimes I'll make 5%, sometimes I'll lose 3%.
And then a couple more questions. I know where, we could talk about this all day. a couple of specific questions that we had. We talked a little bit about the path into these hedge funds for people coming from the sell side. You obviously navigated your path into finance leveraging your MBA. Can you talk a little bit about what the process was like, how critical that was? Obviously, it facilitated the transition from India into the American markets. So I'd love to know a little bit about that. And then if you could talk more broadly about what is specific to the educational and recruiting process in India relative to America. We have a huge international listener base that is really curious about specifics of navigating it in India.
I came to the US because of my eyesight. Or lack of it. I can't tell you by experience, but I can tell you from other people's experience that I understand. So I think there is a very solid IIT, IIM, which I'm guessing your listeners know who.
IIT, I've heard of. I haven't, but again, that's just my ignorance. We are ignorant Americans when it comes to this.
All I know is with IIT, it's like what, 0.1% acceptance or like 1% acceptance rate? Like, you think Harvard's hard to get into, try IIT.
No, it's like 0.001%.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No, so the Indian Institute of Technology and the Indian Institute of Management, fantastic group of institutions. And, you know, those people have a very solid path to getting into the financial markets, whether it is in India or it is in Asia, Pacific, New York or London or something. But most people from India join as an analyst in a bank, and then they work their way higher up in the country, or then they get promoted and they go into the APAC region, the Asia Pacific region. And then some of them find their way into Europe or the US or something. But if you're keenly focused on Wall Street, a lot of others do, you know, the undergrad IIT degree, and then they come and do a master's at Princeton or a lot of these amazing institutions in the US, and then they find their way to Wall Street. I think MBA recruiting is a big deal in the US, or used to be before. Fortunately, till I graduated and a couple of years after, I think they've stopped recruiting a lot of MBAs now into the sales and trading side. So I got lucky in that sense as well. And the analyst route is still very open. And then even a lot of the management grads from India, they also still join. Because other than the IIT, unless you do an MBA from the Indian Institute of Management, you don't find yourself in some of these larger financial institutions in the world working from India. So that's the route. And I think it's a pretty well-established route. Unlike the United States, in India, you need to do either engineering or math, statistics or finance to find your way into a bank. In the US, you still have a lot of diversified education that you can do and still find yourself in a bank or something.
That's what I was really curious to understand. Like, so it's a very, very narrow path.
I actually wanted to ask, so for you, because you were at Blue Crest and then obviously like Citadel and Balyasny, I know you were basically like at the most prestigious, the biggest, have performed the best. My understanding is a lot of these shops have like internal business development and like internal headhunters. Can you talk a little bit about the hiring process?
Very easily, because business development teams, they're called. They do a fantastic job of identifying talent from across the board. They also work with the recruiters, so placement consultants or headhunters from the street. I fortunately found all my jobs through connections.
Why am I not surprised that it was networking, Ashish?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, Wharton does that to you. But anyway. but yeah. I mean, actually, honestly, it is just that people in the markets get to know you. And once you do, okay, you get recommended and things like that, or people reach out to you. So that's how I got my roles. But again, even for me, I had to talk to the business development folks, were, you know, a lovely bunch. And they give you an idea about what the fund is. And they're the, like the preliminary filters and sanity check people. And they assess you, obviously. And if that conversation goes well, then they put you in front of the actual risk takers and things like that, or the managers. So that's how it works.
Do you build like a sample portfolio and say like, here's what I would put on right now? Like,
fortunately at my level, I haven't had to do that for a while, but a lot of people have had to do that or have to do that. Basically, you know, people coming from A, who don't have buy side experience, or B, who have little buy side experience, for them to judge. You will, in fact, again, without naming a fund, I also had to do a psychological test at some point, which is like a
very common,
three-hour long psychological test where I was asked all kinds of questions, which is very, very, I mean, not stressful is the right word, but it can be very, let's call it that.
So was this the one where you don't find out the results at the end too?
Yes.
Oh.
I had to make a business plan for a hedge fund at some point. And some people are asked to write trade ideas and justify them and all kinds of stuff. So it's a mix of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think by the time you're as established as you are, Ashish, much of it is you're effectively a brand name in and of yourself. Everyone has heard about your track record on the street. Everyone knows who you are. It's like, hey, do we now want what he had to offer in our portfolio? It's not, let's grill him on some math questions. Like, I think you're beyond that.
Well, and also, I mean, like there's actual like performance from the past, and like you're exactly. Like, this is my book. Like, I don't know if you're allowed to actually disclose that.
Thanks for being so nice to me. But the fact is, ultimately, the reason I do this job, and again, I'm saying this with all humility as a disabled person, is this is the only job in the world where black is black and white is white. Mm-hmm. My P&L speaks for myself. And honestly, if my boss loves me or hates me, it doesn't affect my career beyond 5% or 10%. So I find it very liberating in that sense. Also, it can be tough because if you had a tough year because of something out of your control, doesn't matter. You've had a tough year and that shows in your numbers. And you get both the upside and the downside of it. But it works for me. And I'm happy with it. So.
What's your greatest savior about it is also what makes it a tough job. And speaking to your thoughtful approach, you've talked about incorporating meditation as a huge part of kind of your personal development and work-life balance. Can you share some of your thoughts on that? You know, especially again, we always talk about these industries as being so cutthroat. How do you navigate mental health and personal balance, and where does meditation factor into that?
So, you know, in my personal life, and I told you my story before, meditation, yoga has been a very integral part of my life since I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And that has kept me grounded. That has also kept me motivated. And it's also changed my life in a lot of ways, in the right way. This job is extremely stressful. I mean, there are lots of stressful jobs in the world, but this would be in the, you know, 10 percentile or 5 percentile stressful jobs in the world, I would guess. It is also very high wired. If you are looking at the world from an investing lens, everything can be used as a data point. How many people showed up at the Christmas market, to what presents did my friends give me this year, to how busy was St. Paul's during the summer, to how many people are buying a certain brand of watch or something. Everything is a data point. And you could just keep thinking about markets all the time. Weekends, again, you have tons of research to read and you have tons of analysis to do. And sometimes the lines get blurred. In fact, I remember when I joined JP Morgan Prop, my first boss, the one thing he said was, congratulations, you've just signed off the next 30 years of your holidays to the markets.
Mm.
And I was like, what are you talking about? But then I realized, I mean, you could be on a nice holiday in Maldives or Mauritius or something. And if dollar yen moves 1%, you will have 20 Bloomberg notifications and 5 salespeople calling you, what do you want to do with your yen position? Or this is what's happening. So you're never on holiday, really, mm-hmm. because the only person responsible is yourself for your portfolio. Again,
the buck stops with you. Yeah.
And I'm talking about, I mean, this is a generalized answer, right? This is what...
Right. As a trader.
Yeah, because, so what meditation and yoga does is it allows you to recenter, refocus, calm down, and it helps you increase your awareness, concentration, and intuition. That's what I say. And for me, that's been super helpful because, you know, when non-farm payrolls come out and suddenly you were hoping that there are 6 rate cuts and they're, you know, we're hoping for a weaker data and suddenly it's, instead of 200K, it's 250K. It's very easy to say, oh shit, suddenly the 1 rate cut is going to be priced out and all that. But that's just one data point. If you take a step back and you don't worry about that 5, 7, 15 basis point move in the markets, if the general trajectory of the data and monetary policies towards cuts, you could still be receiving that uptick in rates or whatever. But that you cannot do when you're in the frenzy of just trying to capture that every basis point. And then for me, that has been very easy to do because you meditate and you know what the bigger picture is and you keep to it. And it allows you to look at everything from a bigger picture perspective.
I love that. Meditation is something I've tried to incorporate into my personal practice and I suck at it. But the good news is my kids love it. So like every night they do a 5-minute meditation. I'm sitting there like looking through Revolve on my phone and they're like doing body awareness meditations. I'm like, yeah, well, at least this is working on someone.
I still have hope that you can meditate. Can Christian meditate is the question.
Oh, can Christian? You got to be kidding me. He's, you know, doomsday prepping in his mind. But speaking of doomsday and averting it, no, but one other thing I wanted to touch on is, I mean, Ashish, not only are you obviously incredibly accomplished in the world of finance, you're also literally making an impact on the world. Can you talk a little bit about your involvement with the World Economic Forum?
Yeah, I mean, I was very surprised when in 2015, the World Economic Forum sent me an email saying I've been selected as a young global leader. A part of me thought this was a joke. But the thing is, it's an amazing group of people where the World Economic Forum identifies about 100 odd people across the world every year and brings them together and has created this big, big group of people over the last now 20 years, actually. This is the 20th year of the Young Global Leaders Program. So we are roughly, I would say, 2,000 people globally that have formed this large network. The idea is that the World Economic Forum doesn't make you do anything. It just brings all these interesting people together. And these are people who are corporates, nonprofit people, political people, and you know, journalists, and all kinds of interesting people. And interesting things evolve out of this. There's a lot of work that happens on the Sustainable Development Goals. There's a lot of work on all kinds of social issues across the world, whether it is Africa or Asia or Latin America, North America. And I'm very fortunate to be a part of this group. And I've met some very interesting people, made some very interesting friends. And the way I describe it is having a group of friends and network that is water on steroids or something like that.
I love that.
That's how I think about it. And like when you go to business school, you know, or...
We wouldn't know. I'm just a business school hanger on. I'm just a Wharton wife.
No, what I wanted to say was, or if you go to an international undergrad program, you meet people from all parts of the world. I mean, this is amazing that suddenly I'm hanging out with someone who is dealing with... Last year, I ended up going to Greenland on an environmental expedition with the Young Global Leaders.
Oh, cool.
And then yesterday night, I was having conversations about how to effectively productively lend in Africa in order to increase productivity and growth. And then my favorite moment was in 2015 when I first became the Young Global Leader. I was in Geneva for the summit. And I had lunch one-on-one with a Kiwi politician who ended up becoming the Prime Minister of New Zealand after a few years, Jacinda Ardern. So, I mean,
that's so cool.
You have no idea who you will run into and all kinds of things, and just amazing. The group is
so you're doing a lot more with your free time than we are. I'm all caught up on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, so I've accomplished a lot this week.
I tried watching that show once, but I gave up after that.
I do not blame you one bit.
Although that homeless, the homeless, not toothless thing, I can't.
I cannot. Well, Ashish, this has been absolutely unbelievable. Are there any things that we didn't touch on? Any parting words of wisdom you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Yes, I actually would. Thanks for asking that question. There are two or three things I want to say. One is we really need to all give it our best when it comes to trying to achieve something, because a lot of us think, you know, it's easy to blame the situation, the circumstances and all that. But I think the first thing we need to do is make sure we give it 100%, because if you don't, then we can't blame anybody else. That's one I would tell people. The second thing I wanted to say is that there are no shortcuts to anything. Of course, some people will disagree because Bitcoin used to be $2,000 or $500 at some point, but it's okay. That's not my place to say. No, but more importantly, just joking about Bitcoin, a lot of friends are big investors and they know what they're doing. I don't. There's no shortcuts to doing anything. So please do put in the right amount of time and effort. And the third thing I can't stress this enough. We are living in a very divided world, and we are living in a world full of conflict. And you know, we can get completely absorbed in our own lives, but there are so many people around us who a small deed, and it doesn't always have to be financial, from simply, you know, giving someone a smile to actually helping someone with, say, taxes or doing their, I don't know, shopping or whatever. There's so many people you can just make a huge difference to by just investing like a very small amount of your time and resource. And if all of us did that, I think the world would be an amazing place. And
I love it. I love it.
That's the only thing I would give your listeners.
Well, Ashish, this has been utterly inspiring and so informative and educational for us. We would love to have you back on at a later date, hopefully when our technology is working properly.
We ended up buying a year thing of Zoom.
We bought Zoom just for you, Ashish.
So we signed up.
That's exactly right.
You guys are doing an amazing, amazing thing. And I love following you guys, and all the best. And it's been really fun.
Thank you so much, Ashish. Best to all of your family. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
See you soon. Bye-bye.
All right, take care. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to The Wall Street Skinny. We are more than just a podcast, so follow us on TikTok and Instagram at The Wall Street Skinny. If you're a visual learner, we have content that will help get you up the curve from valuation to Excel to Bond Fundamentals 101. And if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to our YouTube channel, where we will be publishing in-depth tutorials on all this and more.